From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The Trump administration in search of a policy in Eastern Europe. Hello again, I'm Armin Alny, and this is To the Point. Fighting has flared again in eastern Ukraine. NATO allies are playing military chess with Russia there, in the Balkans, and in the Baltics as well. President Trump's support for NATO, only if members pay their fair share, has undermined confidence in American leadership. Vladimir Putin appears to be taking advantage of local disputes as well as the uncertainty in Washington. Will the president agree to modify economic sanctions despite opposition from powerful members of his own Republican Party? On today's Talking Point later, a 36-year-old mother of two U.S. citizens has been deported to Mexico. Is this the new look in immigration policy? First, the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alny, back with To the Point. In Eastern Europe, Vladimir Putin is stirring many pots at the same time, while President Trump and his foreign policy team face a steep learning curve. We'll hear what that could mean for economic sanctions against Russia and for military action in several countries. Later on today's Talking Point, President Obama prioritized deportation of undocumented immigrants convicted of violent crimes. Today, the Trump administration deported a working mother of two children. She hadn't been back to Mexico for 21 years. Is this a sign of the future? First is news update. Ethics laws prohibit federal officials from using their office for, quote, endorsement of any product, service, or enterprise, close quote. Today, in an interview with Fox News, White House official Kellyanne Conway made this comment about Ivanka Trump's clothing line.
This is just, it's a wonderful line. I own some of it. I'm going to give a free commercial here. Go buy it today, everybody. You can find it online.
Matea Gold covers money and politics for The Washington Post. Good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
Said she was going to give it a free commercial. There's no question she knew what she was doing. What seems to have motivated this?
Well, we saw her boss, the president himself, tweeting yesterday that he thought Nordstrom's was being terribly unfair to his daughter Ivanka. Nordstrom's announced last week they were no longer going to be carrying Ivanka Trump's line. They said it was because of sales issues, that it was not a politically motivated move, but the president claimed that they were taking retribution on his daughter because they did not like his policies. That's something we saw echoed by Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, yesterday in the briefing room. And this morning, Kellyanne Conway then plugged Ivanka's brand. And this is not something that ethics advisors say was advisable, because there are very clear federal regulations that federal employees are banned from using their public office to endorse products.
The president, in his tweet, said that Ivanka had been treated unfairly and said she's a great person. That's a commercial for her, I suppose. So he didn't do the same thing as Kellyanne Conway, but she very directly and indicated to herself that she knew what she was doing, provided a free commercial. You say there are regulations against that. Are there laws against that? Is this something that she could be called to account for?
Well, the regulations are based on federal laws that prohibit federal employees from using their public office for private gain. What the repercussions are a bit up in the air. The Office of Government Ethics, which rolls out these regulations, is actually an agency that functions to give really advice to federal employees to help them avoid ethical conflicts. It is not an enforcement agency per se. So really their only role in this could be to effectively encourage her boss, which is the president, to discipline her in some way. And that discipline could include a suspension for a day or two or a dock of pay. But it remains to be seen whether OG will do that. And even if they did, whether the president would follow through with such a repercussion.
Of course, if you're talking about using your public office for private gain, I suppose that Kellyanne Conway wouldn't, in fact, be gaining anything from this privately. It is not she who owns the clothing line.
Right, but the federal ethics regulations specifically prohibit endorsements of any product, service, or enterprise, so it does not have to be something that would be beneficial to you yourself. So it seems pretty clearly here, ethics experts say that she appeared to violate this regulation. Whether there's going to be any follow from that remains to be seen, but I think what this episode does highlight is, one is that the president and his aides have made it very clear they feel that federal conflict of interest rules do not apply to him, and in many cases they are right. For example, in this case, the president is not subject to the same rule that applies to other federal employees about endorsing products, but it raises larger questions about the message that's being sent from the White House when it comes to the intermingling of private businesses that the Trumps own and their public office.
So the president then could have said the same thing that Kellyanne Conway saw, maybe not that he has a lot of it, but rather that the clothing line is terrific, and that wouldn't have been a violation of any regulation?
Correct. And in fact, we saw the president several weeks ago even specifically endorse L.L. Bean because he said they were being unfairly boycotted because one of their board members had supported his candidacy. So he's already waded into this area. But as I mentioned, this regulation does not affect the president or the vice president for that matter, but it does apply to other federal officials.
If the president did a commercial for his own hotel, would that violate the regulations, or is he immune there too?
Well, I think that would really depend on how it was executed. And, you know, there's a lot of issues here that go beyond just the legal limitations. There are ethical expectations of the president that ethics experts are really urging the White House to take into account, that even if he's in within the letter of the law, he needs, for the sake of his office, to give the public assurances that he's not trying to take advantage of his position to benefit his private enterprise. And so I'm sure that would raise quite a few eyebrows if he did a commercial.
All right. We have an entrepreneurial first family. First Lady Melania Trump, of course, has sued, contending that her earning potential was damaged because she was libeled. That one, of course, is still in court. Matea Gold, always good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today. In a moment, the Trump administration in search for a policy in Eastern Europe. On To the Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. As an inexperienced president takes charge in the U.S., NATO and Russia are rattling sabers from the Baltics to the Balkans. Fighting in eastern Ukraine is more intense than it's been in the past 2 years. We'll start there with Susan Glasser. She is chief international affairs correspondent for Politico, and she is host of a new podcast, The Global Politico. Good luck with that, and thanks very much for joining our program.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Tell us what's going on in Ukraine.
Well, you know, it's really
we seem to have lost. We're losing the line. Can we hear you now? Are you back?
According to Ukrainians and independent observers, is
we got trouble here with the technology, apparently. We're not able to hear Susan Glasser with Politico. We will try very hard to get her back on. In the meantime, let me turn to John Schindler. He's the national security columnist for the New York Observer, also a former National Security Agency counterintelligence officer. Good to have you with us. Can you give us some background on what's going on in eastern Ukraine?
Well, certainly, yes. The Russians have ramped up operations there, particularly their artillery shelling of Ukrainian positions in the Donbas area, which has been under de facto Russian control now since mid-2014. The President Trump doesn't seem to quite figure out what's going on since he's professed he's not sure. But in fact, the separatist forces are fully under the control of the Russian Defense Ministry and the Kremlin. And coincidentally or not, immediately after President Trump and President Putin had their phone call recently, their inaugural presidential phone call, the operational tempo in eastern Ukraine upped significantly and casualties are increasing. The Russians have the ability to turn on or turn off the intensity of the low-level war in eastern Ukraine, and right now they're turning it up.
There are those who say that it may not just be the Russians that have escalated there, that the Ukrainians also have a stake in this, of course, and that they might want to see trouble because they want to be able to appeal to the United States and to NATO to give them some help.
Well, look, of course, the government in Kyiv wants more help from the U.S. and NATO. And in any sort of frozen conflict like this, where you have men with guns staring at each other across no man's land, both sides initiate provocations at a low level. The difference here is the Russians really are unique in the sense that because they logistically supply the forces in eastern Ukraine, and the Russians have the vast majority of the firepower on that battlefield, it is the Russians who are behind this. Lenik is very clear. The Ukrainians are not blameless in this. No one's blameless. But it is Russian aggression in eastern Ukraine, which is the real story here.
John Schindler with the New York Observer. Susan Glasser is back with us now. Again, Chief International Affairs Correspondent for Politico and host of the new podcast, The Global Politico. Is this being seen as a test of the new administration in Washington?
Well, you know, the timing is such that inevitably, even if it wasn't conceived in that manner, it is being seen as a very important early test of the Trump administration because, of course, Donald Trump has very openly talked not only of his admiration for Vladimir Putin, but of his desire to change course on America's policy toward Russia and potentially change or even weaken the sanctions that we've put in place because of Russian incursions into Ukraine. And so, you know, what my sources have told me is that it's possible that this fighting began on the ground and was not necessarily triggered explicitly by Trump, but it will have the effect of being seen in that light no matter what.
Triggered explicitly by Putin, you mean?
Well, exactly. We don't know how much this was a calculated move by the Russians where it began as escalation on the ground. But regardless of how it began, the point is it's clearly going to be seen in the light of what will Trump do and will he, you know, take a harder line on Russian aggression in Ukraine than he has up until now.
We have a new Secretary of State, of course, Rex Tillerson. Formerly with ExxonMobil. I don't know if he has a dog or not, but you obviously do, and that's a nice thing to know about. Has Tillerson had anything to say so far about what's going on in Ukraine or elsewhere in Eastern Europe?
You know, basically, been the word. In fact, it's fascinating, but in the entire, it feels like 3 years that Trump has been president, but it's only been 3 weeks, and there hasn't even been a regular order press briefing by the State Department, which they normally do every day, because there's been such a shaky transition, I would say, and it took a while to get Tillerson in place. There are no deputy appointed yet, so there's really not a functioning leadership of the State Department yet when it comes to something like Russia and Ukraine. And, of course, the career diplomats don't know whether we're changing policy or not. So you really haven't heard in any definitive way. You have heard the new U.N. ambassador, Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina, weigh in with a pretty tough statement about the Russian actions in Ukraine at the U.N. Security Council last week. But we don't know whether that really represents the actual Trump administration policy or not.
John Schindler, back to you. It's my understanding that almost all the leaders, the high-ranking officials in the State Department, either resigned or were fired before Mr. Tillerson took office. Is there a vacuum now in the State Department, and is that causing uncertainty? And is it very important that they try to fill that gap?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a serious problem when you have everyone below the secretary at the State Department waiting for jobs to get filled to see what happens. As Ms. Glasser indicated, the career employees are sort of not sure which direction policy is going to go in. And I want to make very clear here, there's a lot of press coverage of an alleged purge at the State Department, and that's really not true. A lot of officials who, frankly, should have been gone a long time ago finally left. And the fact that the new president would want his own team at the State Department is not abnormal at all. However, what is severely abnormal, as Ms. Glasser referenced, is that we've had, for instance, very strong words from Ambassador Haley at the UN on Ukraine, putting out a position that is consistent with U.S. policy there, that we will not tolerate Russian aggression, just as we've heard comments from Secretary of Defense Mattis strongly supporting NATO, strongly supporting the idea of deterrence in Europe to encourage better Russian behavior. Yet none of this is consistent with the messages we've been getting from the White House itself. So I think far more serious than, you know, who's going to execute the policy, what is the policy? How is it that we have the UN ambassador saying one very clear thing that is consistent with U.S. policy, whereas the president and some of his senior officials have said things on Ukraine and many other vital national security issues that are completely different? What is the Kremlin? What is Kiev? What are our allies supposed to make of all that? And until there is better message discipline between the White House and their senior officials, the world is going to be very confused, and rightly so, and that's a dangerous thing. So these jobs need to get filled, and most importantly, the White House needs to figure out what their policies are.
Despite what, of course, the UN ambassador said, the president has indicated that he's very favorably inclined toward Vladimir Putin. He also commented on NATO. Member nations are supposed to pay 2% of their GDP to stay in NATO. This week at the U.S. Central Command in Florida, the president said he'd support the alliance, but with this proviso.
That also means getting our allies to pay their fair share. It's been a very unfair to us. We strongly support NATO. We only ask that all of the NATO members make their full and proper financial contributions to the NATO alliance, which many of them have not been doing.
Derek Chollet, a senior advisor for the German Marshall Fund. Welcome to our program. Great to have you.
Great to be here. Thanks.
How much uncertainty does that statement has that statement caused in NATO, and what are the consequences of it?
Well, that statement itself hasn't caused a lot of uncertainty. In fact, part of what the president said about the desire for the U.S. to see its allies pay their fair share is consistent with the previous administration's policies going back to Secretary Gates, Secretary Panetta, and Secretary Hagel, the last three secretaries of defense. It's been longstanding policy for NATO nations to pay around 2% of their GDP towards their own defense. And unfortunately, most NATO nations are not meeting that threshold. I think the difference with President Trump is he approaches this from a very transactional and conditional way, in that he has said in the past that if NATO nations do not meet this 2% threshold, if they don't pay more, that the U.S. will withhold its support, that the U.S. would not meet the commitment that it has made to its 27 partners in NATO to come to one another's defense in the event that one of them is under attack. And I think that is the very dangerous part of Trump's message, this idea that U.S. support for our alliance is contingent on this, creates a very destabilizing dynamic within Europe, and also could prove tempting for Vladimir Putin to test.
That's Article 5, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
And the last time Article 5 was invoked, as I understand it, was after 9/11, when the other nations said they would support the United States.
That's absolutely right. It's the one and only time Article 5 has been invoked by NATO.
So, obviously, then, there is a lot at stake. Susan Glasser, I want to go back to you with Politico. Tell us a little bit more about what we mean by transactional diplomacy, conditional diplomacy, and is this something that is new and different as far as NATO is concerned?
Well, it's a good phrase. I mean, you know, although I have to say I take issue only a little bit, which is with the phrase diplomacy. So far, Donald Trump has not been very diplomatic. I think we can all agree. You know, he may yet turn out to be, but so far he has laid down conditions, which is what he wants NATO and other world leaders to do. But that's what's been so striking about the reports of his early phone calls with key allies, not only in Australia, but also in Europe. There's a consistent theme that runs through it, which is that Trump seems to be very personally aggrieved at the idea that we're paying more than what he perceives to be as our fair share into the NATO alliance. This is a complaint Trump had throughout the 2016 campaign, by the way. It echoes concerns and critiques that Barack Obama and his administration had, but it's being voiced in the context, I would say, not of diplomacy so far, but of a very sort of questioning of the very principles on which Americans have participated in this alliance. So
You know, I think the diplomacy part, the jury is out on whether, you know, this is leading towards anything or it is basically Trump laying down a radically different interpretation of how America is going to act in the world.
John Schindler, back to you with the New York Observer. You said earlier, what is U.S. Policy? Do we have a policy when there's all this conflict between the U.N. ambassador and the president himself? Do we have diplomacy? Is it wrong to say transactional diplomacy? We've got something else going on.
Well, as has been hinted at already, the Trump model is of international relations is radically different from anything that we've ever done, no matter who's running the show. It is all perfectly fine to say, you know, NATO members need to pay their actual allegedly required 2% of GDP on defense. As Mr. Chollet said, you know, Bob Gates, Secretary of Defense, hit this very hard back in 2011, that NATO was at risk if members didn't pay up and meet their obligations. That's fine. What is not fine is suggesting that our support is conditional, that really we might not come to your aid if you don't pay this, and heck, Biden throw you out. That's not normal. What is also not normal is ignoring normal diplomatic channels. Look, presidents talk to other heads of state and heads of government. That's part of their job. In the real world, in the normal world, there's massive amounts of legwork done by staffers and diplomats on all sides to ensure that that phone call, while important, is really a formality. None of that is happening. President Trump is calling up foreign leaders, in some cases reliably reported, basically yelling at them, yelling slogans as if he's on the campaign trail that leaves friends and others deeply confused, particularly because the messaging I'm no doubt they're getting from other parts of the U.S. government is radically different. This goes beyond a message in discipline problem. This is a basic dysfunction of how we're dealing with our friends and rivals around the world. And this really can't go on too much longer without creating serious problems in the international space. We've already seen the People's Republic of China getting deeply upset about President Trump's tweets about Taiwan and the One China policy, and that's just the tip of an iceberg. I'm very concerned that if some discipline doesn't come to this process, we could be creating crises that don't need to exist.
Susan Glasser, what about the situation on Capitol Hill? Senator McCain, Senator Graham have both been very concerned, it would seem to me. They have visited Ukraine recently. There are those who think that because of their visit, the Ukrainians got a little more aggressive than they had been before. What's happening on Capitol Hill, and what sort of reaction is the uncertainty we've heard about getting there? I think we have lost Susan Glasser. Let me put that back. Oh, no, we haven't. There you are.
I think it's very interesting, this dynamic that's emerging between Republicans in the Senate and Trump on these foreign policy questions. Trump basically, right, is in effect against the core kind of center of gravity of Republican foreign policy, whether it's on Russia and NATO or international trade agreements that they've been the main proponents of. John McCain and Lindsey Graham have emerged as sort of these public foils to Trump, and in particular on the issue of extending or not Russia sanctions. Revising Russia sanctions is something Trump said in the campaign he was going to do. Early indications are that he asked his staff to
Once again, the phone has gone out. We're on Skype. That is an uncertain proposition, and we are stuck with it for the moment. We're going to continue this conversation after we take a very brief break. I want to thank Susan Glasser for at least attempting to be on our program, Chief International Affairs Correspondent for Politico and the host of the new podcast, The Global Politico. We'll be back. We'll talk with our current guests and others, including Robert English at USC, formerly with the U.S. Department of Defense, about foreign policy. Does the Trump administration have one? On our talking point later, a 36-year-old working mother has been deported to Mexico. Is this the new look in Trump's immigration policy? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI. Warren Olney back with To the Point. You're talking about U.S. relationships with NATO and with Eastern Europe as well. And the question has been raised, is there a policy? Derek Chollet, once again, is senior advisor for the German Marshall Fund. We heard the word discipline used by John Schindler a moment ago. Are the senators in a position to impose discipline on the Trump administration, or do we have to wait until Rex Tillerson gets his staff together and the president and the ambassador to the U.N. Can determine if they are speaking from the same notepad?
Well, I just want to agree with the previous speakers that this has been the most undisciplined and confusing first few weeks of a new administration, I think, in modern U.S. history, and it sent out many confusing signals. Some of that's to be attributed to the fact so many senior positions are still yet to be filled, and that's somewhat understandable. But then also it's the fact you have a president who is articulating a view of America's role in the world and America's interests that are very different than any president previously has and is really out of sync with the core of his party. I think, unfortunately, this is only going to continue. Next week, Senator McCain will be leading a delegation of 12 other senators to Europe. They'll be in Brussels and Munich for a major security conference. Vice President Pence will also be there. General Mattis, or now Secretary Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, will be there. I would expect that next week you'll be hearing a lot of reassuring noises out of all of those folks, including the Vice President, about U.S. commitment to NATO, about U.S. commitment to Europe and the transatlantic relationship. But that will still not make up for the fact that the President of the United States still routinely either tweets or states his admiration for Putin and questioning of core U.S. commitments. And so I think that even despite efforts by Republican senators, by even the Vice President or the Secretary of Defense to reassure our partners, they'll still be confused about what U.S. policy actually is. And that's why we'll have to watch very closely for what actually changes. U.S. is currently deploying troops to Eastern Europe to shore up NATO's eastern flank. So these are U.S. troops in Poland and the Baltics, the U.S. and other European countries contributing there. Do those deployments continue or do they get rolled back? Does the administration try to lift sanctions on Russia or does it hold the line? So I think as we get into this administration, as folks actually get in their jobs, we'll have to actually have to watch to see what the administration does, perhaps rather than what the president says or tweets.
Once again, we've been hearing about what's going on. The fighting is taking place in eastern Ukraine. We've just heard mentioned that the United States is sending troops along the Polish border, and German troops are going into Lithuania. Very unusual, of course, since World War II. There are actions taking place in Serbia, where a train with a provocative slogan on it was sent toward Kosovo, the breakaway province of Serbia, now an independent country. It was stopped before it got there. Montenegro is becoming a new member of NATO. I want to introduce Robert English. He's an associate professor of international relations and Slavic languages and literature at USC. He's also a former policy analyst for the U.S. Department of Defense. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Are all of these things that are going on from north to south in Eastern Europe and east to west, for that matter, the result of Vladimir Putin? Is he scheming and planning to try to set things up, or are there other explanations that make sense?
There are other explanations. It's a lot more complicated than just this unidirectional kind of approach. And I'm glad, Warren, that you mentioned the Balkans, Serbia, Montenegro, because that provides us a wonderful historical perspective to view what's underway now in more accurate context. Recall that in the 90s, when Yugoslavia broke up, the former Yugoslav and then Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic essentially set loose by encouraging, by funding, supporting logistically and other ways as well, sort of extreme Serbian, especially in Bosnia, but also in Croatia, Serb nationalists, who then did the majority of killing and ethnic cleansing. And he tried, Milosevic, to sort of keep his distance from them, pretend he wasn't controlling them, use them to, you know, expand Serbian territory and interests. But in the end, he wanted to rein them in. When it came time for the Vance Owen proposal and later moving up to Rambouillet after Dayton, he had a strong interest in cutting them off. They now, these radicals, remember Karadzic and Mladic, among others, indicted war criminals, were now, it was backfiring. It was time to stop the fighting, and Serbia wanted a settlement, and he could not control them. And I believe something like that is underway on both sides in this Ukraine conflict. I disagree with Mr. Schindler. Putin does not exercise direct control. They are not fully under his control, the Russian separatists. He controls their logistics in the long run, but they have supplies of weapons to keep the fighting going for a long time, even against Putin's wishes. And by the same token, Ukrainian President Poroshenko does not fully control Ukrainian forces. And I have in mind here the extreme nationalist or the far-right battalions who do what they want and are, you know, much more heavily involved in provocations and fighting. So, yes, the Balkans example from the 90s reminds us that these leaders do not exercise daily control. The fog of war is at work. And once conflict is set in motion, it goes where it will based on local provocations and incidents that spin out of control, and it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle.
Well, then, if we ask you whether the U.S. has a policy, what sort of a policy would be effective there? What interests do we have in that area? How do we protect them?
Well, if you're asking about what's underway in Montenegro and Serbia, that's an entirely separate conversation. I would only say about that that we make a fundamental mistake if we immediately approach what's happening in the former Yugoslavian republics as if it's all a U.S.-Russian east-west geopolitical contest. What's happening in those countries, instability, what happens in the elections, populist leaders and so forth, has much more to do with the economy and people's dissatisfaction with their prolonged, abysmal standards of living. And we blind ourselves to the real priorities when we interpret everything as Putin's hand or a U.S.-Russian contest. As for Ukraine, again here, on the same line of understanding how little control we have, or less than we imagine, don't forget that the U.S. sanctions, right, that are at issue here, will Trump try to lift them prematurely without getting Russian concessions? What's he likely to do? Let's not forget that our sanctions, the ones he can control, are minuscule in effect on Russia. In any case, the sanctions that matter are the European Union sanctions. They do, or they used to do, hundreds of millions in trade with Russia. And those are the ones that are hurting the Russian economy and the ones the Russians most want to see lifted. That's where it will be decided. So we shouldn't forget the opinions of Germans, French, British in this whole discussion and which direction German, French, and British politics are moving. What I mean to say by that is those sanctions could be going away anyway. And there's a strong case to be made to look more than 1 week or 1 month out, look at the trajectory of politics in Western Europe to understand, you know, the possible unity or disunity of the West in the face of Putin down the road. It's not only Trump. It's what's happening domestically in those European countries, which will substantially alter the balance of power and unity on the Western side.
Let me go back to John Schindler, again with the New York Observer, a former National Security Agency counterintelligence officer. Professor English says that he disagrees with you about who's got any control and suggests that in eastern Ukraine, nobody does.
Well, that's what an academic would say. Here's the reality. Is Mr. Putin waking up first thing in the morning and telling the motor rifle brigades and Donbass what to do? Of course not. But the reality is this, well known by U.S. intelligence, is that the forces in eastern Ukraine, the Russian forces, the local troops are almost entirely Ukrainian citizens of Russian background, but the officer corps are Russians on loan, and these function as two separate army corps of the Russian army. They could not last for a day without the logistical support of the Russian Ministry of Defense. Since the previous speaker mentioned the Balkans, it is exactly like the Balkans, just not the way he thinks. During the Bosnian War, the Bosnian Serb army was completely controlled by the Yugoslav military, not necessarily Slobodan Milosevic. There was some tension there. But you don't know much about armies if you don't understand that they don't have shells, bullets, beans, petroleum oil, lubricants for very long without a logistical supply chain. The idea that Putin does not have control over the forces in eastern Ukraine is Kremlin propaganda. That is simply not true. They can turn it on and turn it off whenever they feel like it. And for their own reasons, which are only partly to do with us, they are turning it on right now. And that is a situation we are in. And anyone who tells you different doesn't know what they're talking about.
Robert English, how do you respond to that?
Well, I can't deny that I'm an academic, but I have quite a bit of field experience, including in the Balkans. That's my own extraction and earlier residence. What can I say? I think we're splitting hairs here. My point was, because the question you asked was, who's responsible for the recent upsurge in fighting? Like, which side escalated first? My answer was, we don't know, and it's as likely as that's the Ukrainian side as the Russian side, and the decisions were taken by local extremists, not necessarily in Kiev or Moscow. Mr. Schindler, of course, is correct that in the long run, the control of logistics and supplies means that the Russian separatists couldn't fight for a long time without running out of those weapons, those munitions. But of course, on a day-to-day basis, they can launch a barrage, an incursion. They can, you know, initiate an offensive without, for weeks, worrying about whether they'll run out of shells. We're talking about two different things here, but I think your question was really about who fired first on a day-to-day basis. And on that basis, you know, with the answer to that question, Putin does not have that sort of direct day-to-day, every move you make kind of control.
Let me go back to Derek Chollet again with the German Marshall Fund. It was mentioned a moment ago that Western Europe is very much involved in all of this, particularly given that it's the EU sanctions rather than the American sanctions that are really making a difference for the Russians. What about Western Europe, where there are elections coming up and there seems to be a great deal of confusion there as well in terms of what the relationship is with Russia, what it is with the United States, for that matter, with the United States now sort of policy-less?
Well, it's right. And it's sort of what's happened is conventional wisdom has been turned on its head, because conventional wisdom usually is that the United States is the one that wants to remain tough and strong against Russia, and it's our allies in Europe for a variety of reasons that are quote-unquote weak on Russia. And it seems, at least for the moment, the dynamic is a little different, where it's European leaders, for example, Angela Merkel, I think most notably, the Chancellor of Germany, who's been more engaged than any other world leader on the Ukraine crisis and is someone who is determined to remain very strong and tough against Putin. Now, how she and others may react to a U.S. effort to lift its own sanctions against Russia remains to be seen. But then this points up the broader issue that you've mentioned, which is right this year in Europe, in the next 8 months, we have very important presidential leadership elections in France, in the Netherlands, and then in September in Germany. There's no question that Russia will play the same kind of role in that campaign as it did in our campaign last year. Russia arguably will do more in France and Germany in particular to try to influence those elections, whether it's the spread of fake news, or to try to support opposition in those countries.
What's their goal?
Well, their goal is to undermine the current leadership in Europe. I mean, they would love to see a Le Pen win in France. They would love to bring Merkel down in Germany. They would like to see a greater instability throughout Europe. They would like to see a U.S. and Europe that are further divided from one another and a NATO that's weakened. I mean, that serves their interests. So I would expect that we will be seeing a lot of attention over the next 8 months to Russia's behavior in Germany. And I think the question that many in Europe are asking, and this is the unusual part right now, is there are many Germans who are reading the words of Steve Bannon, who's a senior advisor to President Trump, and what he's been said over the years about Western Europe, the European Union, and wondering whether the Trump administration may end up playing a role similar to Russia in trying to put their thumb on the scales in the German elections this fall.
John Schindler, very quickly, we're almost out of time, but when Senator McCain, Senator Graham, and others go to Europe, according to, in addition to Vice President Pence and the Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, what do you hope they'll do?
Well, I hope what they will do is make clear that President Trump is not making decisions on his own, and there are experienced people in Washington who understand the stakes here vis-a-vis Russia, with the NATO alliance, with Atlantic security in general, because some reassurance is very badly needed. I talk on a daily basis with our European partners, and there is at best confusion, at worst real fear that America is looking away. And Russia stands to benefit, and the cause of free markets and free societies is at risk. So Senator McCain and others will send that message very strongly, as they always do. But whether that's enough, if the White House continues on the current course, I don't know that it is.
Robert English, is it now up to the Congress or the Senate, and perhaps with the Vice President's assistance, to make foreign policy in the absence of what's coming out of the White House and the State Department?
Whenever the members of Congress start making foreign policy, I get nervous. That's a lot of individual executives and a lot of chaos. What I really want to say is
fine. It's important to know what Russia's up to counter subversion, meddling in domestic politics in Western Europe, looking forward to these critical elections and the direction of the EU. However, we delude ourselves, we distract ourselves from the main issues if we put all our emphasis on countering Putin. If anyone thinks that Marine Le Pen's popularity or the alternative for Germany or Brexit and British nationalists down the list, Hungary, if they think that those parties, those populists, those nationalists' growing popularity is because of Putin's meddling, primarily or even in any significant way, they are wrong. It has to do with domestic economic issues, it has to do with immigration, a clash of cultures, and so much else. And we shouldn't take our eye off of that. If we focus only on Putin, we overestimate his power and strength, and we ignore the real core issues that threaten us and European and Western unity in the long run.
All right. Enormously complicated situation and many points of view that need to be brought to bear. Robert English, again, at USC, former policy analyst for the U.S. Department of Defense. Thanks to you. Thanks to Derek Chollet of the German Marshall Fund, John Schindler with the New York Observer, formerly National Security Agency counterintelligence officer, and our earlier guest, Susan Glasser with Politico, host of the new podcast, The Global Politico. Thank you all. In a moment, a new look in American policy toward undocumented workers. This is To the Point from Public Radio International. We're only back with today's talking point. That's the sound of protest last night in Phoenix, Arizona, where immigration officials arrested Guadalupe Garcia de Arreos. She had showed up to check at the immigration office, as she has done regularly for 8 years, ever since she was picked up in a workplace raid for using a fake Social Security card. Now, until yesterday, it was just a formality. She's been allowed to leave. This time was different. She was arrested, and today she was deported. Daniel Gonzalez covers immigration, Latino issues, and minority communities for the Arizona Republic. Thanks a lot for joining our program.
Nice to be here.
Sad story. Tell us what it was. Who did she leave behind when she was deported to Mexico?
She left behind her husband, who's also undocumented, and then two children who are both U.S. citizens. They were born here. One is a 14-year-old girl. The other is a 16-year-old boy, and they're both high school students in a suburb of Phoenix called Mesa.
Has there been any threat to pick up the husband?
No, but I think he's concerned about that because when we talked to him, he declined to give his name. So I think he's afraid that could be a possibility. But on the other hand, he also has been very outspoken. He was there at the protest last night. He was on television. They just wrapped up a news conference outside of ICE. So clearly, if ICE wanted to take him into custody, they could have just walked out their front doors and picked him up.
Ms. Garcia de Reyes hasn't been to Mexico, as I understand it, for 21 years. Is that right?
I believe that's right, yes. So she's lived here for over two decades.
So does anybody know what she's going to do when she's in Nogales? Has she been heard from?
She has been heard from. We have a reporter in Nogales who's right at this minute trying to make contact with her. There is a shelter there that is run jointly by Catholic priests on the U.S. side and the Mexican side, and this shelter is specifically for people who are deported back to Mexico, like this woman, people who have lived in the United States for a long period of time and all of a sudden find themselves in a country that they haven't visited in many, many years, and so they provide shelter for them, they give them food, they give them clothing, and so it's our understanding that she is now at that shelter. It's called the Kino Border Initiative. She's resting, and in the meantime, her relatives, I believe it's her husband and her kids and some supporters are going to head down to Nogales shortly. It was a very emotional scene at that news conference when the daughter described packing the belongings for her mom to bring down for her.
What did they say to each other? And when you say it was emotional, was there... just tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, the daughter was describing, I assume this happened this morning, because I think when she went to check in, she thought she could be taken into custody, but I don't think she had anything with her. And the daughter described how she was going through her mother's things at their home and packing up her suitcase so that she could have something to survive now that she's been deported to Mexico. She was you know, frankly sobbing, describing, you know, what, you know, having to do that, knowing that her mom has been taken away from her.
Trying to find things that were useful and familiar, presumably, as well. Now, she was picked up 8 years ago in a workplace raid for using a fake Social Security card. A lot of people under those circumstances go into hiding. She did not. She reported on a regular basis to the Immigration Service. Have they explained why she, of all people, was one that they decided to deport?
They haven't yet. The statement that we received from ICE yesterday was that she had this removal. She had been given a final order of removal, and that she could have been removed at any time. And apparently, yesterday when she went in for her check-in, they decided that they were going to take her into custody. The lawyer described going through this process with her for her routine checkup, how they went in, they had her check-in sheet. She's gone there. This was her eighth time checking in. He brought the paperwork. They sat in the lobby for about an hour and a half, and someone came down from ICE and said that they hadn't decided yet what they were going to do. He was prepared in case they took her into custody. He had some documents requesting a stay of removal, and he said, if you do decide to take her into custody, I want to present this these documents at requesting a stay. A little while later, they came down. They said that they announced that they were going to take her into custody, and she left with the ICE officials. Then the lawyer walked out without her.
I take it that this is the result of an executive order by President Trump expanding the undocumented immigrants that are considered to be a priority for a deportation. What are the consequences or likely possible consequences of this? How many people are we talking about?
I would guess here in the Phoenix area alone, there's got to be probably hundreds of people who check in with ICE on a regular basis, and across the country, I would guess it's probably in the thousands. I should note that the supporters, the activists, the lawyer, they are all contending very strongly that her being taken into custody and being deported is a direct result of President Trump's executive order on January 25th, greatly expanding the number of people who are eligible for deportations. But I should note that they mentioned that there were two other people that they're aware of that also had check-ins recently, one in Utah and one in New Jersey, and those people were allowed to continue to be on supervision or released. They were not taken into custody. So it's still too early to know whether this is going to become the policy, whether it is for sure a direct result, but it certainly seems that way considering that for seven previous times she was allowed to stay with her family, and on this time, just a few weeks after this policy, the order was signed by Donald Trump, that she was taken into custody and very quickly deported.
Should point out that in the Los Angeles area, that's where we're broadcasting from, more than a million people might be affected by this order. So what's been the reaction then in Phoenix, particularly among people who have been checking in on a regular basis? Are they going into hiding? Are they going to stop doing that?
We don't know yet what's going to happen with those people, but I think there is a strong likelihood that, and this was the message that the lawyer and some of the immigrant advocates sent this morning, that if you're someone who checks in with ICE, you're going to want to rethink that. And they said that one option is that people might want to find a church to take in a sanctuary, or they might go into hiding. Or if they go and report, check in as they have, they could be taking that chance that they could be taken into custody and deported. I would imagine that's probably is what's going to happen. People are going to have to think very strongly about checking in, and I think, you know, part of what this whole protest that happened yesterday was about sending that message.
So these are people that ICE just has to wait for because they come and check in. Is there any indication that they are out scouting around looking for others who might now have a priority in terms of deportation?
I haven't heard that. I don't know. I don't. I it would be hard for me to kind of speculate whether that's going to happen or not. I did ask somebody about that last week in another story that I wrote about how ICE is going to depend very heavily to achieve what President Trump's executive order asked for. To accomplish that goal is going to rely very heavily on the cooperation of local police. And I asked, do you think that's going to also entail going back and finding some of the people who ICE had come into contact in the past but had either closed their cases or were just under supervision? And this person felt that they would be looking forward, that their main goal is to the people who come into local police custody in the future. That's who ICE would be focusing on, but it's really too early to say what will happen.
Just a very few seconds left, but do you think there will be more protests if, in fact, these deportations continue?
I definitely think that what we saw in Phoenix is something that we're going to see a lot more of, both in the Phoenix area and across the country. I think that's the message has been sent, that there is going to be a lot of resistance to President Trump carrying out these immigration orders.
Daniel Gonzalez, again, covers immigration, Latino issues, and minority communities for the Arizona Republic. Many thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.